Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Laundromat Millionaire Show. I'm really excited about today's guest. Today we have with us Rafael Collazo, who is a commercial real estate agent in Kentucky, the author of several books on the topic, and a renowned speaker and performance coach. So he has a lot of great advice to us, especially about whether to buy or lease that real estate when you're getting into the laundromat business.
Yeah, also as a double bonus, he's actually a branding expert. And so he's going to talk to us about how to brand our laundromats and maybe even how to do a little social media to help promote our business. I think a lot of times, Carla, we just think about social media from the aspect of posting on Facebook and LinkedIn and things like that about our laundromat and maybe a picture or two. But he actually goes a lot deeper and explains to us how to use video and how to use your own personal voice to promote your local laundromat's brand and how to build a brand around what most people consider to be a boring business. So let's jump right into this episode. We'll see you in just a minute. All right. So welcome to the show, Rafael. How are you doing today, man?
Can't complain. I'm here with you guys, and I'm looking forward to the discussion that we have. This weekend was nice. It was, you know, pretty laid back, which is always a nice weekend. So
yeah, we appreciate you joining us. And for those of y'all that maybe skipped over the intro or whatever, Rafael is a commercial real estate expert. So he's an expert in, you know, the world expert. I always say when people call me a laundromat expert, I'm like, what does that mean? Do I need a certificate for that? How does that look? Is that self-proclaimed? How does that work? But I actually know Rafael. We've gotten to know each other a little bit. He's in Louisville, Kentucky, which is only a couple hours from Cincinnati. We met up. I was on his podcast and kind of shared my laundromat journey. And then I went down to a real estate meetup he had down there and got to know him a little bit better. So some of our guests that come on the show, we're just kind of getting to know. And I feel like I know you a little bit more than the average guest that we have on the show. And I'm super excited that you are willing to take the time, because as we were kind of talking offline, our industry needs more knowledge and experience on leasing and commercial real estate. What does that look like? Even if it comes to just a perspective of understanding the other side of the aisle when you're negotiating a lease. And I'm sure you have a lot of good tips and advice for us on strategy and things like that. So that's kind of what this episode is going to be about, is just kind of drilling down on this. And one of the things Rafael shared with us offline before we started recording was that, you know, a lot of these different industries, the product doesn't really matter, but the strategies behind it and things like that are different. Can you talk about that a little bit, what you were referring to?
Yeah. I mean, I think we had touched on, you know, the logic between leasing and buying a space. And, you know, obviously from a laundromat perspective, I have not worked too much in the laundromat space, but the questions that you were kind of posing kind of had a lot of parallels to the quick service dining space, which I have operated in for a little while now. And, you know, the logic there really is that, you know, if in fact, is it worth it to just lease the space and then invest a dollar into your business? Because that's probably going to give you a higher return than, you know, you would achieve just by buying a building. And it may slow your growth as far as expanding to multiple different locations. And then the flip side is concerned is that as you start building up the equity within the properties, now that becomes kind of a tool for you, so that as the economy shifts, and in the laundromat space, it may be slightly different than in other markets. But, you know, as the economy starts to shift and the economy slows down, now you have firepower to be able to expand in a situation and hopefully pick up, you know, opportunities. So it's just, you know, the slow and steady approach versus the expanding much more quickly approach. And, you know, it really just depends on the individual.
Sure.
How they want to take it.
Well, as we go through the episode, we definitely want to dive into that more, but thanks for the quick synopsis there. What we want to do to just get started today, Rafael, is just kind of back up a little bit. I know you actually have some experience in the software industry, and I don't know, maybe more of your experience is in the software industry, and you parlayed out of that industry into commercial real estate. So we want to kind of talk through that, but let's go back a little bit before that. What was growing up for you like in your household? And we always like to hit that backstory, and I know a lot of podcasts do, but I think the reason a lot of podcasts do is because it's relevant. I've always said knowing how you grew up and how you were treated and raised, good, bad, indifferent, kind of is a big part of what makes us who we are. Sometimes what drives the ambitions and what feeds stubbornness and things like that. Can you tell us kind of a little bit about what it was like growing up in your house?
Yeah, no, definitely. So actually, I was born in Northeast Italy. My dad was really? In the Air Force. Okay. Yeah, my dad was in the Air Force. He was stationed in Aviano Air Base, and that's where he met my mother. And so I was kind of an army brat. So we moved around a lot. I lived in Germany for a couple of years. Then we were in Belgium. And then ultimately I moved to Arizona just off the base of Fort Huachuca, which is a military intelligence base outside of in Sierra Vista, Arizona. My dad was a pediatrician for the government. So he operated in a civilian capacity for them after he left the Air Force when I was like 8 or 9 years old. I went to Arizona State University for college, studied in industrial engineering and economics, and then got into the software business. So I was a software implementation consultant for a company that implemented software systems for government agencies. And I worked in DC for a couple of years. I worked in Puerto Rico as we implemented a large financial software system for the island. And then ultimately, after Hurricane Maria hit, that project got put temporarily on hold. And that's what moved me to Louisville. It became more of a permanent basis because the project manager wanted to keep me around. And, you know, I'd always kind of thought about doing something entrepreneurial. I had a small catering company in college that, you know, I leveraged outside of college as well. I got into an incubator in Phoenix and had the opportunity to manage a restaurant for a bit. So I really thought I was going to go the restaurant route. I realized pretty quickly it wasn't what I wanted to do long term. And then, you know, got into what I did before. But I made the transition to real estate right around mid 2019, and I've just been operating in the commercial space ever since. I haven't done any residential real estate. I'm strictly focused on commercial properties.
Mm-hmm. So, what caused you to be attracted to that? Did you have some situation where you were like dipping your toe in it and you were like, this is intriguing? Or did you know a mentor? What was it that brought you into that space?
Yeah, it's a great question. So my mom actually got into the residential real estate from the brokerage standpoint in 2010. After the crash, and she's a pretty successful residential agent in Arizona. And just hearing her stories about what she's doing and dealing with, I just thought there's no way I could, you know, operate in that space. You know, yeah. it's very much a nights and weekends type of job. You know, the home buying experience can be a very, you know, emotional experience. You know, I'm obviously someone who's very focused, just the way I operate is very logical and very, you know, numbers focused.
You're a software person. You're exactly. a software person.
So that's stereotype exactly. driven, yeah. very yeah. That yeah. black and white. Brain.
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea that I don't buy a house because the color of the walls are not what I want is just, it boggles my mind. So, but on the business route, I've, like I said, I had a small catering company in college. So I've always been somewhat entrepreneurial, and the idea of helping business owners help them achieve their American dream was very attractive to me. And that's kind of what pushed me in that direction. And I'm glad I made the decision. Obviously it comes with its challenges early on. You know, it definitely is not for the faint of heart, especially the first year or two. But it is it's a great industry, and I'm glad I made the decision to transition.
Awesome. So you have a couple of books out. You have Before You Sign That Lease and Before You Buy That Building. Let's go first with the leasing side. So what kind of advice do you give people, business owners, before they sign a lease?
Yeah. So, you know, tailoring it more so on the laundromat side, because it really just depends on the individual. A lot of times, you know, when you seek out a commercial agent, you need to have a few things lined up even before you start approaching me, because I've definitely talked to a lot of entrepreneurs that have this idea of what they would like to do. But then when we start digging into the business plan side of things, they're not prepared.
They don't have
their ducks in a row. So from my perspective, it's like there's nothing I can do to help you unless you at least have an idea of how you're going to approach the process. And so, you know, getting your financial documents in order, you know, having a clear understanding and a business plan. So utilizing the services of something like a small business development center helps a lot. You know, obviously you guys provide mentorship for individuals, so you'll be able to point them in the right direction. But really getting very clear on what you're looking for is the starting point. And then from there, I can come in and really help fit them in the space that actually it makes sense for them. As far as the leasing side is concerned, a lot of times the biggest problem with a lot of people who don't utilize someone like myself is that they don't clearly understand the ramifications of the document that they're signing. Mm-hmm. You know, unlike a purchase contract where it's consummated in one day, a lease you live with for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And so I've looked at some leases before where I'm just shocked. And I'm like, you obviously didn't either read this lease or, you know, you essentially put yourself in a very bad position. So, you know, as far as provisions within the lease that I usually recommend is like, you got to think about the worst case scenarios at all times. So, you know, having a sublease provision in place, which allows you to lease the space to a third party. If in fact, for some reason, the business doesn't work out, at least that gives you somewhat of an out to be able to alleviate some of the financial burden.
Are commercial property owners typically apprehensive to give you a sublease?
Well, they'll want approval. So they won't just say, hey, you know, you can rent it out to whoever you want typically. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at least it'll give you the opportunity to present them with a potential tenant. And if they have a better financial standing than you, it would behoove the landlord to move forward and allow you to be able to sublease the space to them. So, right. You know, oftentimes it makes sense for the landlord as well. You know, exclusivity is another thing. I know a lot of people, especially on the retail side, where, you know, if you sign a lease, let's say you're a liquor store and you sign a lease in a strip center, you would probably want to be the only liquor store in that entire center, because otherwise you're going to cannibalize each other's sales. And you know, most of the time landlords are cognizant of that, but there's some times where that's not the case. And I've seen it where, you know, people, you know, one use is here and then right next door, there's another use that's a competitor. And you're like, you know, that doesn't really help you as a client. So that's one. And then, you know, as far as the build out costs, which we alluded to earlier, I mean, similar to the restaurant side of things, I mean, it's very expensive to build out, you know, laundromats. We talked about plumbing, you talked about ventilation, you talk about, you know, and you had talked about down here at the meetup how you have had to expand the sewer line because maybe there's so much water going into the sewer. So that's another thing that needs to be considered. So, you know, sometimes you can negotiate tenant improvement with the landlord, which just allows you to essentially pay for the cost up front. And then the landlord will reimburse you a certain amount of money for the improvements that you've made to the space.
There's nothing better than free. Ever heard that before? Well, it's not true. You know what your laundromat customers like even better than free? It's fast. That's right, they want to save time more than they want to save money in most cases. They want to get in and out of your laundromat as fast as possible, and they'll pay more for that experience. We're proof of that here in Cincinnati. That's why we added HM Company drain troughs into our newest store in Cincinnati. While they may never know why, your customers will love that your washers all drain better and faster than with old school drain pipes. As if that wasn't enough, every HM drain trough is made in the USA, so they ship in only a few weeks and everyone is custom made just for you and your project. If you want to provide your customers with a top of the industry experience in your store, then contact your distributor to order your HM Company drain trough today or visit draintroughs.com. When it comes to, Raphael, since you have a lot of experience in commercial real estate, when it comes to TI money, do you know, is there a, and this is totally off the wall, when it comes to the property owner themselves, is there typically a, let's call it a light formula of how they determine, okay, if you sign a 5-year lease at X amount of rent rate, then I'm willing to give a 3% TI allowance. How did they come to that conclusion? Or is it just literally, I don't know, sure, 20 grand works? There has to be some kind of a formula they use.
Yeah. So, you know, and
just so we know what's reasonable from the other side of the,
I would say if you're looking to sign a 5-year lease, you know, a year's worth of rent is probably a fair request. Let's say it's a $5,000 a month lease. It's a 5-year lease. If you request $60,000 in tenant improvement allowance for signing a 5-year lease, you know, that would be somewhat reasonable. Okay. I mean, I would feel comfortable submitting that as a proposal. Mm-hmm. You know, they may request that part of that amount be amortized over the course of the lease. That just depends. Mm-hmm. And that's all the negotiation piece, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what I would say is maybe a rule of thumb. And obviously, it's all dependent on the use, right? So if you're a rock solid person and you have the solid financial backing, you know, landlords are willing to do a little bit more as far as, you know, incentivizing you to sign a lease at the space. Whereas if you're just a startup, that's another thing that it's hard for a lot of people to understand is that, you know, there people that are startups, the landlord's taking a risk by allowing you to move into the space. And, you know, your improvements to the space may not be applicable to the next user. So the idea that you spend $50,000 in the space, I hear this all the time. It's like, well, if I invest $50,000 in the space, he can keep that if I were to decide to leave. And I said, well, if I don't know, a daycare decides they want to rent the space, then they're just going to rip out everything anyways, right? So the improvements have no value to, you know, the new user. And so, you know, it is a kind of a give and take type of situation.
Yeah, that's a good point. We in the laundromat industry, we always talking about how we are an ideal long-term tenant. We are an ideal anchor tenant. Of course, this is predicated on the fact you run your business the right way, bring value to the shopping center and things like that. I've never really thought about it, but I've used that against a property owner when they had a vacated space that was really run down. Is I said, I didn't say it to them, but I thought to myself, I'm like, they kind of have an albatross on their hands. Like their option is to lease this to me, make a sweetheart deal with me, let me come in and clean up their mess and have a viable business, which is what they chose to do. But the other side of the equation is, or they have to go in, and I always call it unlaundromat the space. They have to actually spend 20, 30, 40 grand sometimes to turn it back into a white box space. So I guess I never thought about it from the other perspective of when it is a white box space and I want to go in there and do X, what's the risk proposition associated with being on the other side of the table? I guess it all goes back to what kind of confidence do they have in me and my industry?
Yeah. And you as a person, right? Or you as a business, right? Because you could have solid backing from a financial standpoint, in which case, you know, there may be a guarantee there or a document on the side that allows them to feel a little bit more comfortable with leasing you the space and knowing that you're going to be able to comply with the terms of the lease. But, you know, in a situation where you don't have the balance sheet to support it, you know, it's a give and take, right? The landlord doesn't run a charity. So it's understanding how you can position yourself in a way that makes it the most attractive for the landlord to take a chance if you're starting out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fantastic point.
Never thought about it like
that. So what are some other things that you recommend asking for in a lease, or things you've seen maybe that you could ask for that you're kind of surprised people came up with?
Yeah. I mean, really, it's the major components of the building that shouldn't be the responsibility of the tenant, right? So, you know, sometimes you'll see landlords try to sneak in where you're responsible for covering all the expenses pertaining to the HVAC unit, elevators, you know, roofing, structure. So in those situations, that could be very expensive if, in fact, you know, it's an old system and, you know, it just decides to conk out. I mean, that's something that a lot of business owners fail to look at, and that could really hurt them in the long run. You know, other things I can think of off the top of my head, getting options to renew. You know, we mentioned, if you're investing a lot of money into a space, you want to make sure you have control of that space for a long period of time. So typically speaking, you could have that on the front end of the term. So if you sign a 5-year lease, that'll be your 5-year term, but maybe you want to add another 5-year option on the back end and try to see if you can define what the rent's going to be at the front end of the lease, as opposed to just saying, oh yeah, we'll rent it to you at market rate come 5 years from now, because market rate in 5 years may be double what you originally paid for. So
a lot harder to plan for.
Yeah, exactly. And I usually that's one thing I'll typically do is if there's an option on the back end, I'll be like, okay, let's define what that option rent is going to be today so that you have certainty in knowing what your cash flow is going to look like in year 5, 6, 7, 8, et cetera.
Yeah. I've had success too. And just pointing out to them that gives you security. You have that same assurance now. Yeah. We're not balancing the risk reward of, okay, you could be leaving money on the table too. Of course. That's the other side of the equation. Did you have something?
I was going to say, we recommend for laundromat owners, just because of the investment in the infrastructure that they have to do in a leased space to turn it into a laundromat, 20 years worth of, you know, lease or lease control. Options. Yeah.
That's smart. And you'll see that a lot in the quick service dining space. You'll see, you know, 10-year leases and with options on the back end. If you're talking about doing a land lease, which I know is not necessarily very common in the laundromat space, but where you're leasing a piece of land and then developing property on that land, those leases could run 50 plus years.
Because
at the end of that lease term, the building reverts back to the owner. So
do you have any guidelines or even warnings about CAM, looking for CAM in the lease?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's clearly defining what CAM is, because, you know, sometimes they start you know, throwing in extra expenses that really shouldn't be involved in the CAM charges. I've seen situations where water is affiliated with CAM, and obviously as a laundromat user, you're going to be water heavy. In which case, the other tenants may be responsible for absorbing some of that cost, but vice versa. So if you're just a regular retail shop and next door there's a laundromat or maybe a dog groomer or, you know, some other water heavy use, you just want to make sure that it's clearly delineated within the lease that I pay, you know, whatever the amount is, and I'm not responsible for the excess water that other tenants are responsible for. So, you know, obviously with taxes, it's kind of interesting because you can always ask the landlord to challenge tax assessments periodically just to make sure that you in fact are keeping the tax range within a reasonable expectation. So
I didn't realize. So are like the real estate taxes often included in CAM?
Oh, always. Yeah.
Yeah.
Always.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I didn't even realize that.
Taxes and insurance are. So, you know, and obviously
it's like the staples.
Yeah, those are the main two, and then obviously general maintenance. You know that typically
I just thought it was all maintenance stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, we pay it. I guess I don't read the leases. That's his job. Yeah,
that's true.
So we talked about offline too that when a lot of laundromat owners, you see in like these, you know, Facebook groups and things like that, people are like, hey, how much of a value should I put on acquiring the real estate? You know, if it's going to require X amount of my capital, it might keep me from expanding into 2, 3, 5 stores faster. Generally, what I see the conversations going at is, well, every situation's different. Are you looking to build cash flow? Are you looking to build equity? You know, not that you can't do that in a retail business either. Do you ever get anyone come to you and they're like, you know, I could purchase this property. Do you help them navigate whether that's the right decision for them? And if you do, what kind of guidance and mentorship do you give them over that?
You know, as you like to say, it really just depends. But in reality, it does. I mean, there's a course that we take as part of our CCIM designation. I haven't received it yet, but I've already completed all the coursework, and it's called User Decision Analysis. And essentially what they do is they give you that exact scenario. It's like, hey, I'm a company and I'm looking to purchase a property or lease a property. Tell me what you think as far as whether or not I should do either or. And so, you know, it really just depends on what, you know, your preferences. If a dollar invested in your business gives you 25% return, real estate realistically is not going to give you more than, you know, let's say 8 to 12% in a perfect scenario, right? You 12% if you just hit it out of the park. And that's obviously if you were to purchase it outright. So if you're talking about purchasing real estate outright, if you get a 12% return on the money you have invested, you're doing very well. Whereas with a retail business, you may be talking 25, 30% on the dollar you have invested. And so from a return metric standpoint, obviously, it makes sense to lease versus to own. However, as you said before, there is something to be said about owning real estate because in situations where the market is fluctuating, you know, and the economy shifts, you have equity that's built up and now you can capitalize on different opportunities that present themselves. I guess what I'm saying is that it really just depends on whether or not you prefer the stability of owning your own business and not being kicked out at a certain point in time. And also the fact that you can capitalize on opportunities with the equity you have built up in the real estate, or if you just prefer to expand as large as you can and, you know, benefit from the cash flow. Again, it's an individual's preference. And obviously there's another thing to be said about expanding to a certain point. And whenever you feel comfortable as far as your expansion is concerned, then you can look to divert some of that cash to other assets as well. So it's just there's different ways to skin a cat, as they say.
Yeah.
Do you recommend people that are going through this process of deciding whether to buy or lease contact a commercial real estate investor that has the certification that you were talking about? Is that part of that certification is to help your clients decide whether to buy or lease?
Well, the certification itself is it's called the Certified Commercial Investment Member designation. Essentially, what it does is it allows you to present data in a way that is readable for someone so they can make the determination, because I can provide you with all the information and all the data, but ultimately you're the person who has to make the decision. You could say, hey, look, if you invest money into your business, it's going to give you 25% return. But if you were to invest it in this real estate, it'd be 12% return. But you know, if you'd prefer to own your building, you know, you're going to say, okay, I appreciate that information, but this is something that I want to do. in which case you're the person that decides to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's completely fine. There's no one size fits all approach, but, sure. But typically, you know, I would recommend someone in particular, if they're looking to determine to figure out what they want to do, to talk to someone who's a CCIM because of that, because they can present the data in a format that makes you understand whether or not it could be a potentially good decision for you.
Yeah. Help you make an informed decision.
So, Carla, if you don't have any other questions, I want to dive into this book for a minute.
That's why I'm ready for the next book. I want to talk about what to do before you buy.
Yeah. So you wrote this book, and I know it just recently came out. So guys, go grab this book. Raphael, where can they get both of your books for that matter? Amazon?
Amazon. Correct. Okay. Yeah. Amazon.
So tell us about this new book that you just released.
It's part of the series. So, you know, the logic there is the first book was Before You Sign That Lease. Then this book is called Before You Buy That Building. The next book that I'm almost done with, I'm about 80% complete with, is Before You Sell That Building. And then, you know, I'm going to get more into the development side. So we'll write a book that's called Before You Develop That Building. And then finally, as we start raising money to do some of these deals, the book called Before You Invest in That Building will come out. And that's really the passive investor's guide to vet a sponsor, someone who's going to be taking the money to go buy opportunities or redevelop opportunities or whatever their function is within that.
And just to be clear, this is all around commercial real estate.
Correct. 100%. Yes. It'll all be commercial real estate focused.
Okay. So what's the reason that you wrote this book other than obviously just to, you know, build your brand, which we understand that part of it?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, it probably similar to you. You receive the same questions over and over and over and over again. It's like, well, maybe I need to, you know, address this in a format. Exactly. Right. So it's like, if you get the same questions over and over and over again, you start to see a pattern emerge and you say, okay, well, if there was a way for me to write something that then I can share with the people that I'm working with or whoever could gain value from it, and that'll help expedite whatever the process, then there's value add there. And so that's why I wrote the book, because I was helping people buy buildings for their business. And that's the lens with which I viewed this, this book. There's a lot of investment books out there, but there's not as many books that talk to the business owner and say, okay, you know, you've been leasing a building for 5-10 years. Now you really are wanting to buy a building to house your business in as an owner user. What are the steps you need to take? Mm-hmm. So that's the lens with which I viewed the book.
Okay. And just from a high level, can you walk us through some of those foundational steps that you cover in the book?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think setting expectations on the front end is usually what I do. So, you know, determining whether or not it is right to lease versus to own, we kind of went over some of the reasons why you may want to lease versus own. So we touch on that a little bit in the front end of the book. I touch on, you know, the process itself of buying a commercial building, a lot different than buying a residential property. The timelines are a lot longer. You know, a lot of times you're going to require business and personal tax returns and, you know, other things that are involved with the process. The build out costs can be extremely expensive. So making sure you contract or contact several commercial contractors to give you a few bids on what the work would look like. Then we start diving into the process of searching for a building and getting really clear on exactly what you need, because you don't want to get to a point where you're looking at a lot of random stuff and realizing that it's not exactly what you want. And so really getting clear on what your criteria are is very important. And then once we start getting into the process of acquiring a property, contract negotiations, what are some of the due diligence items that you need to take into consideration? And then contingencies within a contract to allow for you to back out of a deal if it in fact is not right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we talk about the inspection contingency, the financing contingency, you know, in situations like, you know, laundromats and dry cleaners, there's environmental issues that could potentially be present. And so there's usually an environmental contingency that I recommend. If there's any rezoning that needs to take place, and for those of you guys who don't know what zoning is, throughout cities or across the nation, you have a particular designation for a building that allows for certain uses to operate on site. You can't just open up, I would imagine in Cincinnati, it's probably this way. You can't just go to a residential neighborhood, open a house, go into a house and just open up a laundromat. Mm-hmm. That's not how it works. So you have to understand where in the city certain zoning designations are and make sure that the building itself is allows for whatever use you want to occupy that space. And if it doesn't, what are the steps you need to take to make sure that you can get it to that point? So usually that's either a rezoning process or there may be conditional use permits that you need to secure. So there's different ways to approach it. And each municipality is going to have its own process. So really that's why it's so important to work with someone locally. And then, yeah. And then on the back end, really, it's just making sure that, you know, you execute on the build out, if there is a build out. Because again, you have to hold people accountable to making sure things get done, because otherwise, you know how it is. You what is it? You inspect what you expect. Mm-hmm. So you just got to make sure you get people on track and keep it on track, because especially in this environment where supplies are hard to come by, you know, subcontractors are extremely busy, in particular if they're good at what they do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's just a lot more variables to consider as you're going through the process.
You know, it's funny. I've noticed in the laundromat industry that a lot of people that approach leases do it on their own, DIY. Mm-hmm. And then I will sometimes, not always, obviously, but sometimes I will look at those leases later if I mm-hmm. end up coaching them down the road. And sometimes they're just really, really awful. I just want to, part of the reason we wanted to bring Rafael on here is because he's very good at what he does. He's a mm-hmm. super sharp individual who's very passionate. Even though, you know, some people may say, well, you haven't been doing this for 30 years. You're not an expert, or you don't have the 10,000 hours or all these different arbitrary numbers. All I know is you're really sharp and you're really passionate. And mm-hmm. I compare hiring a commercial property agent, whether you're leasing or purchasing a property, similar to like a coach, in the sense of, yes, there's a cost associated with that. But what I always tell people is any professional that you hire, their services should essentially pay for themselves plus some. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I see so many people approach leasing and commercial property purchasing even sometimes without a coach, without a agent, without a representative who's received formal training, but also has experience in this industry. So I just want to call attention to the point. A lot of people are like, why would I want to pay an agent? Whatever. By the way, what is a reasonable fee to pay an agent for like a lease negotiation?
So the funny thing is that on the leasing side, you know, the person who's leasing the space doesn't pay anything. It's typically really? it's typically the owner of the property that pays the fees involved in the transaction. So what usually happens is, let's say you're a property owner and you have a vacant space, you'll approach a commercial real estate agent and say, hey, I'd like you to lease the space. They'll sign a listing agreement with the property owner. And essentially what it is, they'll typically charge around 6% of the total amount of rent paid over the term of whatever the lease agreement is. And that's to be split between the listing agent, the person who is representing the owner, and the leasing agent, the one who's mm-hmm. representing the person who ultimately leases the space. So, you know, as a commission, the seller is the one paying, or the owner of the property is typically paying the mm-hmm. commissions. And so that's another reason why I'm always kind of baffled by when people don't use an agent. It's like mm-hmm. you're not really directly paying for the services. So
right.
Yeah. So that I hope that enlightens the process.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I'll be honest with you. I didn't know that until you told me that. It makes sense. I mean, that's how the real estate world works mm-hmm. on the residential side.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to tell me one agent handles the whole thing. I'm like,
no.
Conflict there.
Well, and that's another thing you need to be very careful of. And so, for example, here in Kentucky, you can operate as what's known as a dual agent, which is exactly mm-hmm. the scenario you're describing. And I've done it once and I felt kind of uneasy about it, and I haven't done it since. So that exact reason, you need to be very careful, because in a lot of states, that is the case. California is the same way. I interviewed a gentleman in California. It seems like that's the way as well. So you want to make sure that the person who's representing you is just representing you. They're not involved with the landlord, because you're right, there's a conflict of interest.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Fantastic. All right, everybody. So go and pick up that book before you buy that building on Amazon, and before you buy that before you lease that building on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Are they available anywhere else?
Before you audiobook sign that lease.
Or anything like
before
that?
You sign that lease. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes.
Yeah. Before you sign that
Rafael
lease.
Rafael Collazo. Which your last name?
it's Collazo. Collazo.
We always want to pronounce the L. Sorry about that.
No worries.
All right. No worries. So before we let you go today, I do want to dig in a little bit on building a brand, because I know that you're somewhat of a branding expert, and probably in this conversation, it's really referencing like branding your laundromat, you know, branding your retail business, if you will. And I know you work with a lot of powerful brands, whether it's franchises and things like that. What advice do you have on that? And the reason I bring this up is I know it's something you have a lot of experience in, but there's kind of a odd debate in our industry right now, because it's a little embarrassing, but for like 70, 80 years that our industry has been around, probably 70, 80, 90% of the laundromats are called coin laundry or laundromat or washateria or what have you. They don't actually have it. Like, that's like, you look them up. It's just the laundromat over on, you know, Fifth Street or whatever. They literally,
they'll just use their address, Fifth Street Laundromat.
Yes. And I will full disclosure. When I first got in the industry, you know, our we could only afford limited signage because we were pretty broke, and our signage just said Coin Laundry on the building. Now, we did have a name on the door, but the signage overhead, we had just enough money to put the functionality what our product was overhead. But I'm just curious what advice you have. But I think this is a really powerful thing for our industry to understand. And we are creating a lot of conversation and debate, healthy debate around this. So I'm curious your thoughts on just branding a retail business in general and the power associated with that.
Yeah, no, and that's a great question. And I think branding itself is it's extremely powerful, because if you were to put up a, let's say, a swoosh, what do you think immediately?
Nike.
You think Nike, right? And how does that make you feel inside? So the branding concept is that, you know, if you create a powerful enough brand, people will naturally gravitate towards it. And not only that, but if you establish yourself as a certain type of brand, you know, there's Dollar Generals that appeal to a certain demographic, but then there's also like the Lululemons that appeal to another proportion of individuals as well. So really getting clear on what you want to be known for and what target audience you have is probably the starting point. And then from there, it's creating content and targeting areas of the market where those people operate. So in the case of laundromats, I imagine Facebook may be a pretty big place where, you know, you can create a pretty strong brand. So you create video content, you create, you know, TikTok's been huge on that front, Instagram. So, you know, for me, how I started was I started creating video content on YouTube. Just created short, quick videos on frequently asked questions. I started doing a lot of virtual meetups, especially during COVID. This was much more popular. And people started attending, and I'd capture email information and start shooting out the videos in a variety of different capacities. And I started building a little brand on YouTube, and then got into the podcasting format, where I would convert the videos that I created into a Audible format and then start distributing that. And so you start to repurpose content. So you're not necessarily having to put so much effort into creating content on a regular basis, which is one of the things that holds a lot of people back, because they realize, oh my gosh, this is going to take me so much time and so much energy. But in reality, you can take one piece of content and create four or five different things that you can distribute on different platforms. And so, you know, as far as a branding perspective, the reason why it's important to build a brand is because you want your audience to feel a certain way when they hear your name. And if in fact they see, you know, your brand, and over time they associate that with excellence and quality, whenever they see it anywhere else, or they have their friends that are down the street and you know, they'll talk about you. So I think that's maybe just a high level reason why branding, you know, is so valuable. And I don't know if you want me to dive in any other strategies, I guess, pertaining to how to build one.
Well, yeah. If you have any tips and advice on how to do so, I mean, I think the value of branding is one debate. I'm not sure why, to be honest. But the value of branding is, and then yeah, I think that's, if you have a few extra minutes, I appreciate it. So, what would someone that has a retail business, in this case a laundromat, that hasn't branded it, they don't understand the value associated with that? Okay, maybe we explained a little bit of the value of why to do that, but maybe they're like, I don't even know how to build a brand for my laundromat. Any advice there?
Yeah, no, I would say, you know, start small. So I would probably start just creating quick videos and, you know, talking a little bit about yourself and your journey and who you are, and then explaining to the audience why you're doing what you're doing. So the documentation piece is something that's a lot easier for people to do than it is to create brand new unique content on a day-to-day basis. And that's why I think that's a good starting point. It doesn't necessarily even have to be like, you know, full-length video, 20 minutes or whatever else. It could just be literally you putting up your phone and sharing an Instagram story about what you're doing today, and maybe some of the specials you guys are running, or, you know, what you did on the weekend. And so people start knowing who you are and what you do on a regular basis. And the cool thing about these apps, in particular Instagram and TikTok, is they're geo-specific. So they'll target all the people that are close to your location. And, you know, if you create reels or TikTok videos as well, it'll start coming up on people's feeds that are close by to you. Which is very powerful for laundromats in particular, because that's probably your target audience. A lot of the people who utilize laundromats are probably within a three mile radius. Mm-hmm. If I would imagine, maybe
3 to 5.
Yeah, yep. maybe not more than 5. Yeah, I mean, once you start getting outside of the 5 mile radius, I'm sure that makes a difference whether or not they decide to use that laundromat versus mm-hmm. something else. And so, mm-hmm. The geocentric or geospecific apps in particular are probably the most powerful to target. And I would focus on Reels. I'd focus on stories, and I'd focus on, you know, creating video content so people can see who you are, get to know you.
Man, what great advice. I hear us laundromat owners talking all the time in different groups and connections and stuff at conferences, and they'll make reference to, just social media. But I think 99%, I could be wrong, but I think 99% of them are just associated with having a Facebook page and posting on there that we're a laundromat and here's our address. And yeah, maybe we have a $10 comforter cleaning special and that's about it. But I heard you talking an awful lot about video. I heard you talking an awful lot about the way I understood it is kind of creating this combination of a personal brand as the owner of the business and making an emotional connection to the community and tying that in with the brand, the name of your laundromat. So I think a lot of retail businesses, honestly, I think the owners are always apprehensive to be a part of the brand. But when I think of I'm going to date myself a little, but when I think of the old days of advertising on TV and things like that, which were the most powerful ones? Well, it was the guy that got up there and sold himself as Billy Bob, who had the local Chevy dealership, and everybody in town, he was this minor celebrity because he was always doing commercials on TV, and he made himself part of the business versus staying away from the business. And honestly, that's something we haven't done a very good job of.
Yeah, I know. And you're right. Powerful. I mean, people do business with people they like and trust, right? Mm-hmm. So building that brand in a way that people are attracted to coming to your laundromat, not to Bob's laundromat down the street. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's super powerful. And obviously leveraging those geocentric apps, in particular Instagram and TikTok, because the way the algorithm works for some of those apps is that they will put the content in front of people that are within your region, your radius.
Interesting.
And so that would be most powerful for laundromats in particular. Reels and TikToks and Instagram Reels in particular are super powerful. Mm-hmm.
And for those of you that don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but Instagram Reels are just short videos on Instagram.
Correct.
Everybody calls short videos TikToks nowadays.
Oh yeah. No. And there's a difference between posting a video on Instagram and a reel. Right. Reels are a separate section of Instagram, and Instagram has really focused its efforts on promoting reels. And so as far as the algorithm is concerned, you can post a video and it can hit 5,000 impressions within 30 minutes. I mean, just because of the algorithm and the way it works. And in the case of a laundromat owner, you know, those users are usually going to be within a geocentric radius. Mm-hmm. And so same with TikTok. TikTok's the same way. So if I were a laundromat owner, I was getting started, I would focus heavy on TikTok and I'd focus heavy on Instagram Reels. Mm-hmm. And kind of that would be the basis of my strategy online.
Yeah. Oh, that's really powerful. Thanks for sharing that. That wasn't where I was expecting you to go with it, but that's even more valuable, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. All right. Did you have anything else for him before we go?
I don't think so. So, audience, make sure you look for the book. So before you buy that building and before you sign that lease by Raphael, mm-hmm. I'll try again. Coyazo.
Better. And before we let you go today, how can people reach out to you? Because I know you do have a personal brand of your commercial real estate, and you're always bringing value to people that, you know, may not necessarily ever live in Louisville or be a client of yours. I know that's why you write the book and things like this. How can people reach out to you and follow you? You mentioned you have a YouTube channel. So guys, go check out his YouTube channel, but tell them where they can find you, man. Because I know after this interview, our industry is going to want more of what you're doing.
Absolutely, man. No, I, first off, I'm really honored to be here, and it's been a blessing to get to know you over the last year or so. It's kind of by happenstance we got connected, so it's really cool to be able to be here. But as far as getting connected, you know, I have a website. You can go to my website at www.raphaelcollazo.com. You could see all the different things that I'm up to there. LinkedIn is also, I'm very active on LinkedIn. So if you'd like to add me on LinkedIn, feel free to do so. And then, like you said, YouTube, I'm heavy on YouTube, and a lot of different social platforms. So feel free to add me on all platforms. And I'm super easy to get a hold of. If you have any questions, just feel free to reach out.
Yeah, that's awesome. So is your YouTube just your name as well?
Yes. Yeah. It's okay. Just my name. It's like a personal YouTube channel.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I know I've been following it. I didn't know what it was called, but I've been following it for a while now, and it's been kind of mini blowing up for a while there, right? You should be pretty excited about that.
Yeah, no, it's grown some serious pretty good
momentum. Yeah,
I know. And that's a thing with anything in life, right? It's the small, positive, consistent action over time adds up to big results. And so, you know, that's kind of the approach that I take. I know that's the approach you guys took. And, you know, I think that's the success formula. So,
yeah. Well, I don't want to run over that. What you just said, say that again real quick. And everyone out there, I want you to apply. I want you to think about this in the context of applying it to your business. Maybe you're a laundromat owner. Maybe you're trying to be a laundromat owner. I think a lot of times, Raphael, we get overwhelmed by the macro. Mm-hmm. And I like to talk about the macro because I'm a big picture thinker. But this is honestly the key to success. Can you say that again real quick?
Yes. So it's small, positive, consistent action over time adds up to massive results. And it's called the compound effect. Mm-hmm. So, you know, So that's the way
that
to do it.
That's a lot.
there's a book called The Compound Effect that I read when I was 23, and that changed my life. And that's the concept. It's that, you know,
compound effect.
Yeah. And I applied all the time when I was writing books is 250 words a day in 200 days, you have a 200 page book. Mm-hmm. If you want to double that in 100 days, you have a 200 page book. If you write 500 words a day. So that's 500 words a day. Anyone can write 500 words a day if they really set their mind to it. You know, mm-hmm. I'm assuming if you apply to a business development standpoint, if you have four conversations a day, you know, that's 20 a week. And if, you know, 5% of those individuals decide to go with you, then you get a new opportunity per week. Right. So you can apply the same logic. And that's why I think it's so powerful that people apply to their life is that you just have to pick a few things and do those every day.
Diligence. Powerful. Thanks for dropping that nugget there at the very end, man. I didn't want to gloss over that. Mm-hmm. Well, listen, man, obviously we've had a few opportunities to connect and I hope we continue to have more, but thank you for taking the time out of your day to do this with me and Carla, because I'm not sure you understand the value that you just brought to our industry. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that, because that's ultimately what we're all about. Sometimes we bring the value. Most of the time we bring guests on and they bring the value and we just get out of the way. but thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you for this. Yeah, we appreciate it. All right, everyone back home, we will see y'all next week for another episode of the Laundromat Millionaire Show. Dave Menz, my beautiful wife, Carla, and our friend Raphael Cagliazzo in Louisville, Kentucky. Make sure you check him out. Make sure you go get his books. We'll see you next time. Take care, everyone.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.